Okay, good morning and welcome to ITE 2 Module 8. Hope you all had a wonderful week. Okay, I don't think there's enough people to start off with a quiz this morning, so we'll just get stuck straight into the lecture. I might do the quiz because it's an interesting one from last week. And we can just do it with Kerry and Grace and Akhilesh. Okay. All right.
Why don't we do the quiz in about 10:15 or whatever, because Grace is messing with USB audio.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, we could. Oh, that's okay. No worries. It's actually an interesting quiz, so I just thought it might be a good one to do. So, all right, well, we'll come back to the quiz. So, all right, today we're going to talk about the Windows 2000 operating system and installing the operating system. So basically, you've got four steps in the installation. So first, I guess, is you've got to verify that your system is compatible, and we're going to talk all about how to do so. So you've got the installation, administrator. As an administrator, we're going to talk about the user interface that you can select, as in the GUI or the command line interface. Setting up user accounts, managing the file system, and also your services that you want to set up on that.
I'm just going to make a point here actually. If you haven't yet started looking at the virtual machines area, and you haven't started looking at the VMware and the tutorials and all of those sorts of things, this would be the good module to start getting started, because we're going to be using the Windows 2000 virtual machines to complete the labs and stuff. This lab will explain to you how Windows 2000 has been installed and can be installed. We have already done the pre-installation for you on the virtual machines. So, and just a reminder, we don't write this down anywhere, although if you email the instructors, we will give it to you. The username and password for the VMware area on the QCAT website is VMware for the username and images for the images. Sorry, I'll throw it back to you now, Geraldine, but I thought now we're getting into the operating system nitty-gritty, it might be time for them to start getting hold of those virtual machines. And if you're in India, talk to the people at your academy. They should have DVDs of the virtual machines.
Thanks, Kerry. No, it's a very good point, so that's good. And you'll have lots of fun with the virtual machines anyway. It's great fun. And I think most of the students find that. They enjoy playing around with them, because if you get to crash them, you can always set up another one. So it's a really good thing to be able to do that and not be having an adverse effect on your own computer.
We actually have one of our students here who will remain nameless, because we don't want to name and shame people, but he's hosted his virtual machines a number of times and got them back up and running again, and is now continuing on and completing the rest of ITE2, so certainly saves a lot of time.
I think it's also a good time to remind students that don't leave your labs till the end, because there are 62 labs in ITE2, and we cannot pass you on ITE2 until we've seen and passed all your labs. So if you don't want to cause your instructor to have a heart attack when she gets 62 labs in the last week to mark, she might not be very happy about that. Please submit them as you're going along, because it's less stressful on you and less stressful on me, so we're all happy then.
I would just like to point out also that, you know, we would like to see the labs come in on time. The other thing that we should also keep in mind is that whilst you're all very busy people and you're really busy working on this, that and the other, if you do one lab every day or two, you'll find that the 62 labs go a lot faster than if you do them all in a stint of 12 hours of absolute horror lab doing. So try and knock one or two of them over a day. One of our students who's sitting next to me has been doing that. She's knocked over a couple of the little ones, and that will be two less that she has to knock over before the end of the course. So see if you can knock the especially considering that a few of the first ones are fill-in-the-blank worksheets. So they shouldn't be too difficult to fill in, we'd hope.
And the labs are actually designed to... each lab is designed for each module. So by doing the labs as you go along, as you've done each module, you do the labs, it reinforces what you've learned in the module and makes it all sink in a little bit better. Now, some of the information that we're going to talk about today is a little out of date, so but you will need, and we are working on that, we are developing a new ITE2 course for next year, but to pass your exams you will need to know the information that we're telling you that is in this module. So all right, so Microsoft actually recommend that you have a system prior to installing your Windows 2000 operating system, and these are important because they're in your exam. You will need a Pentium 133 megahertz or higher microprocessor, 64 meg of RAM, these are the minimum, okay, 2 gig hard drive or partition with a minimum of 1 gig of free space, a VGA monitor, 12x CD-ROM as a minimum, and a network card. Now, as I said, a lot of this, you would want a lot more powerful computer, but that is the minimum, and those questions come up in the exams, don't they, Gary?
They certainly do, they are important minimum specifications that you do need to know, because they do ask you about how much RAM you need and what processor speed and stuff like that. Good luck finding a Pentium 133 today, although given some of the people I know, it's still possible. We're about to turf one out into the wheelie bin in a few days, but we won't be installing Windows 2000 on that one. You still got a 133, have you? Oh. Oh, no, that's a 333. We're talking about a 133. No, yours is too new. No, even Kieran's computer's too new.
Okay, yeah, so a lot of these things that we're telling you, you know, may be well out of date, but you do need them to pass these exams. So you do need to remember them. Aren't we kind to you? Also, Microsoft has a tool that can help you, which is called the HCL, or the Hardware Compatibility List. And what that does is you can verify the hardware that's going to work with your Windows 2000 machine. And that provides you with the all of the drivers that have been previously tested, and they are included on that hardware compatibility list. It's important to sort of be looking at your HCL, so when you're doing an install, to make sure that everything is going to work well together. As I mentioned before, four main steps in the installation of Windows 2000. You've got the setup program, which brings up a setup wizard. It's pretty much follow the bouncing ball. Then you're installing your Windows networking, and then you're completing the setup program. So the first step, as I said, setting up the program is the first step, and you prepare the hard drive for the other stages of the installation process. What happens next is that files that you have that are needed to run the setup wizard are copied, and the text portion of the setup gets displayed on your screen. You can actually install your Windows 2000 installation from your setup boot disk, or by booting from the CD-ROM. If your boot disk, if you choose the boot disks, you insert the first disk in the computer, turn it on, and then follow the bouncing ball, and you'll find there's about, I think from memory, 3 disks for a Windows 2000 installation. And what happens is you insert them, and then they begin copying the files. If you're using the 2000 Professional CD-ROM, you'll boot from the CD-ROM, and you'll get a minimal version of Windows 2000 that actually gets copied into the computer's memory, and then it begins the startup program. Then you'll get a whole lot of things that'll say, like things like your licensing agreement, and you have to accept that. It'll ask you about the hard disk partitions, and whether you want to create or delete partitions. You'll do a create and then format that partition, and then you'll begin the Windows 2000 installation on the partition. It'll also ask you whether you want to select FAT or NTFS as the type of file system. And just from, how about we talk about FAT, for example, first. Can anyone tell me what FAT stands for? That's correct, yep. And how about NTFS?
New Technology File System.
Thank you, Kerry, well done. something to bear in mind there is that, and it's important, is to remember that FAT can be converted to NTFS, but you can't do it the other way around by NTFS converted to FAT. And if you wanted to do that, you'd have to reinstall the operating system. And that's just one of the security features that you have with using NTFS.
Unless you've got a copy of Partition Magic, which will let you go back the other way, but that costs money. So when they ask you in the notes, you have to reinstall the operating system, but Partition Magic will convert you back the other way. However, you will lose all of your security descriptors and owner information, so going from NTFS back to FAT is not really a good idea unless you've got a very good reason to do so.
So when you're installing, say you're a network administrator and you want to install on the network, you would most likely be using NTFS would be the preferred because you've got better security on the NTFS file system. So once you've partitioned and formatted, the setup program starts to copy the files to the hard disk and it then saves the configuration information the way you've actually selected it. And then what will happen is that your computer will restart and then it'll come up with a 2000 setup wizard. Okay, what happens with the setup wizard? As I mentioned, it's like following the bouncing balls because everything's sort of put there for you, but don't just go next. Be careful, read what it's asking you. So it'll come up with a GUI on your installation and it'll prompt you to the next stage. So you know, it's important that you're reading what's happening on the screen. You'll get prompted through a series of setup screens and the wizard will keep asking for information. Things like your regional settings. So, for example, in Windows 2000, which is designed to be a global type operating system, you can customize it. So you can pick the language. It'll ask you about what language you want to use. Your locality will be prompted as well. So, for example, if you're in Singapore, it'll ask you for that. If you're in Perth, it'll ask you for Perth. And if you're in Delhi, it'll ask you for your locality. And you can also configure it to use multiple languages. The next thing it will ask is about your name and also the organisation. So, as the administrator, you'd be putting in the name of who's going to be administering the computer. And if you're working for an organisation, you would then put in the name of the organisation. Whoever holds the licence, basically.
And those names and stuff show up as system defaults for all sorts of things. So they end up with Office will default to those names and any other packages you install will default to those username and company names that you actually key in at this point. So putting in the correct ones at this point is probably a good idea because a lot of other programs can then have that information as default if they need it.
Also, the next thing it'll ask you for is the product key. Now, that's a 25 character key and For sighted people, it's on the back of the CD case that your CD comes in. Good idea, I find, with those things is to actually get somebody sighted to tell you what the product key is, and then if you're a braille reader, you can actually braille it on the back and use that back, sticky label, braille label, and put it on the back of the case. If you're not a braille reader, make sure that you take that down somewhere in a document, a text document of some sort, or get it stored somewhere in a way that you can get to it if you need to again.
Lot of us record them on voice recorders, so you get the recorder on the voice recorder, and that way you can play it back on the voice recorder and key it in.
Yeah, but it's important to keep all those things so that you've got them in the future. Same with all your license keys for things you buy, software you buy. Great idea to keep those license keys because you never know when you might need them again.
You can always use a demo later and put it on the computer if you really want it.
Yeah.
Grace.
Yeah, go on. I was just going to say the same.
Okay, you can always use a Dymo labeler and stick it on the side of things, although my experience with Dymo labeler is sometimes the Dymo can fall off. So you've got to make sure that you either metho underneath the surface of the Dymo before you stick it down, or keep an eye on your Dymo labels to make sure that they're not going to peel off things. Also, a 25-digit character key, given the fact that it is letters and numbers, is going to be quite a long piece of Dymo on Braille. So possibly, if you've got a laptop or something, you won't have enough room to stick it on. I would encourage people to store them in text files, on Braille note takers, daisy players, a sheet of Braille, that sort of thing. The other thing I'd caution people to do is if you've got a laptop or something that has an OEM key on the bottom of it, write those OEM keys down somewhere, because eventually they rub off the sticker and you can't read them.
Yes, that's a very good point. Okay. It will also ask you for the computer name, so you're giving each computer that's, if you've got more than one, that's on your network, should have a unique name, so that you can actually identify it on the network. When you're actually thinking about a name, it's by default, it can be no longer than 15 characters. Okay, and okay. Or also, you'll be asked for the password for your administrator account. Please remember your password for your administrator account. Otherwise, you won't be able to get into the computer. Okay, so passwords, we'll talk about a bit later on. We'll talk about how to develop a good password and what is a bad password. So we'll be covering that later in today's module. It'll also ask you for your modem information, and so you'll have to input that information as well, and also, as I mentioned, your date and time settings. Okay, so when you think about Windows 2000, it's been a very popular network operating system, still is, and once you've gathered all of your information together, the install then happens in a series of steps. It detects the network adapter cards, then it installs all your network components. By that I mean the files that you have that allow you to connect to all the other computers and to finally get them all networked and on up and running on the internet as well. Okay, there are a couple of ways that we can configure the install. The setup program will prompt you as to whether you want to do a typical install or a custom install. Can anyone tell me what the difference between those is? What about you, Kerry?
The difference between a typical and a custom install is a typical will select most of the defaults that a general user would accept, and it will dump on most of the usual stuff, and a custom install will allow you to pick which components you wish to install or not install. Now, I seem to remember in the test, and I don't know whether it was for IT1 or IT2, it asks you about the difference between typical, custom and compact installs.
It does.
And a compact install is usually done on laptops, and they tend to avoid things like programs you're not likely to use and all the help files and stuff in order to save disk space. And I remember that being one of the questions. So the manager who wants to install on the laptop probably wants a compact install, if you're doing that question in the test.
That was a compact install, wasn't it?
It was,
for laptops?
Yes.
Okay, yes. So also, you'll have to set up your file and printer sharing. Obviously, you're going to be able to share files amongst computers, and generally you're going to be sharing other resources like your printers. The default network protocol that will allow your computers to communicate over your local area network or your wide area network is TCP/IP. And we've heard that before, haven't we?
They still use that in... They mention that because in Windows versions prior to Windows 2000, Windows XP, the default protocol was actually NetBUI. So that's why they put that point in there too.
Yeah, okay. And that was the next point we had, was about talking about the NetBIOS and the enhanced user interface, or NetBUI, as Kerry just said. And we also have Apple Talk and NW-Link, IPX, SPX, all those type of things. Okay, also as the administrator, you will then be thinking about setting up work groups or domains. So you decide whether or not the computer will be part of a domain or a work group, and that would be then sort of input at that step. If you've got a computer account that's created in the domain for the computer during the installation, the wizard will then prompt you for the name and password that you need to join that domain. And the last step it does is install and configures the networking components that you've just put in. So once you've actually input all the networking components, the wizard will then copy all the additional files and allow you to configure finally configure your setup. And then you go into like a fourth step in the installation process, and that will be where you get the start menu items installed. And that's where all your shortcut items appear on the start menu. It'll register your components, so it'll apply the configuration settings that you specify. It will then save the configuration, and then it'll remove all of the temporary files. So by that what I mean is, while the operating system's installed, you get a number of files that need to be copied, and they're copied so that they can run the next step in the installation. Once they're no longer used, the wizard will automatically delete those files. What will happen then is the computer will restart, and then you can log on to finish your installation. Okay, my next point there was about the typical portable and compact, and Kerry's already covered that, so I'll carry on.
Oops,
oops, that's all right. Okay, some of the add-ons would be something that you would be thinking about next. Once you've got your operating system up and running, you might want to add some add-ons in. And what I mean by that is for Internet Information Services, or ISS. You might also want to set up an FTP web server. And most of those services can be installed from your install disk. And you'll be prompted to insert your CD so that you can do so. It's also an automated service.
It's also in one of the labs. One of your labs gets you to install IIS onto your virtual machine.
Okay, so when you're getting to the logon stage, obviously when you're booting up your computer, once all your install's done, your first thing is to log on to the system. As I mentioned earlier, Windows 2000 comes with a GUI and allows you to log on to the system at a Windows screen. And you'd be after your first booting, the computer will automatically go to a prompt which prompts you to do a Control Alt Delete to display the window. Then you'd get put in your username and your password, and if you are going to a network domain, you may be assigned there to have to input the information you need. For security reasons, when you're typing in your password, if you're a JAWS user, you'll be hearing star, 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 or asterisks. But what will be displayed on the screen is asterisks.
Interestingly enough, there's a bug in JAWS 11 where the first time you key in a password into a password edit field, it will actually echo the keystrokes if you have your keyboard echo set to characters. And then if you fail the password and put it in again, it'll actually say star, star, star. So yeah, bug in JAWS 10. Just an interesting quirk there. So be aware, if you've got people who can understand eloquence standing near your computer, they might understand your password.
Can I just interrupt you for a sec?
I think so, yeah.
Just for listeners of this lecture and whatnot, it's about this time last year and the year before, for the equivalent module, we did a very big session on what makes a good password and what doesn't make a good password, and I would encourage students to get those two lectures out and listen. Just my thought for the day.
Yep, that's fine. We will be talking actually a bit about that as we go along today too. So, but yeah, there is more information on QCAT's site. Okay. Also, remember that your passwords are case sensitive, and you'll certainly know if you get it wrong. You'll get prompted to information that is until you get it correct or until you get locked out, depending on how many times it's set to allow you to.
Remember that time we had that Vista install and we had to cat's lock had been on or something, and we had to figure out what the hell had gone into the password field before we could even get the thing
done it.
That was fun, wasn't it? We got there in the end. Okay. Once you've got through all that login, obviously your GUI will appear, and that's, you know, all your icons will come up, so you'll be hunky-dory and ready to go. Okay. With your most popular GUI systems, you're allowed to, you know, click on, for sighted users, obviously, click on the icon that's there, and everything's very easy to operate. Also, your menus will be available at that stage, and so you'll be, you know, for us, we'll be hitting the Windows key, and that will bring up your menu, and you can actually use your arrow keys to navigate around the menu. Also, at this stage, the taskbar will be appearing, and that appears at the bottom of the screen. For example, in your menu, you'll have sort of the time will be displayed. You'll have all of your network volume, all those types of things being displayed there. Windows 2000 obviously offers you a command line interface as well, and it's based on the MS-DOS operating system in the 80s, and it's referred to in Windows 2000 though as the Windows 2000 command interpreter. Bit of a mouthful. The command interpreter runs on top of Windows 2000 and allows you all the benefits of a command line interface in conjunction with the GUI. And you can get to the command line interface by a number of ways. On your taskbar, you can go start programs, accessories, command prompt, or you can go on the taskbar, select start, or run, and then when you get there, you type in CMD. Now, there is a lot more information in your notes, and I'll refer you back to your notes, because we just try to get through in the lectures all the nitty-gritty that we need to get through.
Sorry, guys, wrong window.
Oh, okay.
I was texting the fearless leader. Sorry.
That's all right. Okay, Windows Explorer is also a fairly important component of Windows 2000, and also the basically been a very important component since about Windows 95. I'm not talking about Internet Explorer there either. I'm talking about Windows Explorer. Okay, Windows E, Windows key E will bring up your Windows Explorer, and what happens then is you get all the all of the files and directories that are on your computer are displayed in Windows Explorer. Just you can also go through it. Go on, Kerry.
I was just going to say, I was going to make an interesting point here. I don't know whether everybody's noticed with Windows Explorer, when you arrow down through the tree view, it tries to open devices to show you what shows up on the right-hand side, where if you arrow down off a floppy drive, it goes... Drive A is not ready. You can actually change the switches that are passed to Explorer.exe to stop those windows from auto-opening, and then that can help with people who are just a bit too slow on the double press of the down arrow to bypass their floppy or their removable drive that has no media in it. So a lot of people didn't realise that you could actually customise how Explorer comes up and what it looks like. So
yeah, that's a very good point. When I'm talking about the Windows key, it's the key that's located between your Control and Alt key, generally. If it's on a laptop, it's probably between your function and alt key, depending on your laptop.
With Toshiba laptops, the Windows key is actually the second in at the top of the keyboard. Generally, there is the left Windows is between the Control and the Alt. Obviously, it depends on the keyboard as to what the right side of the keyboard's got. Usually, there is a right Windows. Sometimes, there's not. But yeah, it's also referred to as the Start button. Its technical name is the Windows key. It was in Windows 2000, but then Microsoft renamed it to the Start button. And you can actually tell under Vista, if you've got a Vista-compatible keyboard or a keyboard that's got the Vista approval on it, there's actually an icon on the Start button that feels like a round orb, and that's actually the logo for the Vista Start button. And for students in here, we'll find a keyboard that's got that orb logo on it so you can feel it, but you can actually differentiate the key by feeling the orb logo on it.
Okay, I think that's pretty much the, you know, covered the sort of starting up bits. Now you're at the stage where you probably want to add users to your account. Obviously, if you're on a network, you're going to want to create accounts for your clients. So before you log on to your Windows 2000 client, you'd be creating your account on your appropriate server. And that account's going to allow you to log on to the domain and using the information that you've created earlier. So in Windows 2000, you use the computer management tool. So you'd go to Start, Programs, Administrative Tools, Computer Management, and that would bring up that window. And that tool will allow you to manage all of the aspects on your computer. Things like authorizing who can use it, and also in the case of your network server, who can access the network domain. If you wanted to create a new user for your local machine, you'd actually expand the directory tree, and that's on the left, and that would bring up your system tools and your local users and groups. So you'd actually go to the users icon and display the user accounts. They appear on the right side of your window, so you'd have to tab across there. And then you'd select on your right one, you'd select your new user, and that will prompt you for all the account information. Your username is actually a required field. It's important though that you remember that it can't be longer than 20 characters. Also, there are a number of characters that you can't use in your username field. Things like forward slash, backslash, think colon, back arrow or less than, greater, and plus, equals, question mark, star. What else am I missing, Kenny? There's a whole list in your notes anyway. Yeah, there's quite a few you can't use. But it'll tell you if you put in a character that it's not allowed. It'll actually let you know that it's not allowed. Okay. So you need also to put in the full name and also a description, because if you're an administrator, you're going to have lots and lots of users, so you need to be able to remember who's who. And then you would go to the Create button, okay? And then you can log on to your computer and with that username and password. Oh, it's starting to get very windy here and very rainy, I think. Can you hear it inside here? Okay, the computer management tool, which I talked about earlier, allows you to add and manage users in Windows 2000. And, you know, the you don't have to remember all your command names, because you can carry out your operations in a number of ways. And the simplest way to manage is to right-click on the username and then select the appropriate task for the menu. So you might, for example, want to go and choose your set password, or you might want to rename a user, and you can do all that through your properties, and that will allow you to also disable accounts or set up a new one. So once you get your virtual machine set up to do the labs, you'll get lots of practice at doing all those things. Another thing that you might need to do is to set permissions. and well, not might need to do, you will need to do. Now, what I mean by that is who can do what on the network. For example, you might want to have, say we've got half a dozen people in here today, we might want to have Peter who can have access to the whole network. And we might want Kerry only to be able to access Word documents.
Gee,
and we might want Grace to be able to access only Excel. Kieran might be able to access three programs on the network, and Topaz might be able to have everything as well. So,
what we're going to be really productive, aren't we?
You would just be quiet and enjoy your Excel, Grace.
Just given the fact that she enjoys Excel about as much as I enjoy Word.
So
at
you
least it's not PowerPoint.
As an administrator, you want to be able to set up who can access what. Now, for example, if you're working in an organisation like a hospital, you might want some of the doctors who can access all of the patient information, and the nurses can access all that. But Joe Bloggs, who just works on the reception desk, you wouldn't want them to be able to access that sort of sensitive information. So you would set permissions, and that's the reason for that. It's a security issue, and it's a rights issue. Who can have access to what? So Windows 2000 will give you a built-in administrator account, and that'll allow you to manage the overall computers. And if your computer is part of a domain, for example, you'd use the built-in administrator account to manage the domain.
Just one tip here, and a lot of people don't tell you this, one of your first security concerns on a Windows NT 2000 XP 2003, you get the idea, 2008 machine, is rename the administrator account. Because a lot of people expect the administrator account to be called administrator, and a lot of viruses actually exploit that fact. And if you actually rename your administrator accounts, that will be one less thing that the viruses will be able to hack into and rely on. So obviously you'll need to know what you rename the administrator accounts to, but just keep that in mind. It is one of the security tips that Microsoft actually recommends. Not many people ever do it, but there you have it.
Windows will automatically add a domain administrator to the, or admins as they call it, to the administrator's domain local group, and that'll allow all the members of the domain admins to perform administrative tasks on your computer anywhere in that domain. And by default, your administrator account is a member of that domain. You can also have enterprise admins, and that's where you can add user accounts to your enterprise administration, and that would be for people on the network who have administrative control of the network. By default, your administrator's built-in local group for each domain is a member of your enterprise admin's global group, and by default, the administrator account is also a member.
Does it go through the difference between local and global groups in these notes? I didn't think it did.
No, it doesn't. No.
Oh, well, very briefly,
you might want to touch on that.
Yeah, I will. Local groups are groups that are created on a specific server, and they are only created on that specific server. So, for example, say we're adding this whole class to our particular server, we could have a local group called, Cavi Idiots, just as an example, and that group would only... that would only exist on the local server. But say, for example, we had some IT people who were administering the whole organisation, we would actually put them in a global group called Absolute Drongos, and the global group would be replicated across the domain infrastructure, whereas the Cavi Idiots group would only be relevant to the server that we're signed in on. So we would actually create the Cavi Idiot group on the local server, and we would use that group to control access to resources on the local server.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so also you're going to, obviously if you're in a network, you're going to be wanting to set up a network, you know, creating folders, directories, so that you could share folders and files and also do backups. First thing you'd need to do is navigate to the directory where you wanted to share the folders, where you're going to create it, and then you'd right click on the desktop if you're using your mouse and choose new. Then you'd select the folder, and then you would actually give that folder a name. We'll go through the shortcuts for doing that with JAWS, and for us who don't use a mouse.
Which is Shift F10 to pull up the context menu, unless you can find your context key, and then go down to New Folder down that way. So that's certainly one way you can make that happen. I had something else to say, but it's gone, so we'll just move on.
Yeah. Well, it'll give you an option too. By right-clicking on that folder, you can select Sharing. Okay, so if you haven't got that selected, there's a little radio button that allows you to do that too. And if you haven't got selected, you won't be getting the sharing of files and folders, so important to have that set up.
I was just going to say that if a folder is shared, and I think this is in the test, the icon above the folder is a hand. There's a pointing hand.
That's it. It is in your test too.
And the hand is actually, I didn't realise this, but the hand is actually a guy's hand, and he's wearing a suit. You can actually see the sleeve of the suit on his hand, the things that cyber people tell you. But yes, there is a hand that shows up over the folder if it's shared. You can also go into your computer administrative tools, and you can do this under XP and Vista and stuff. You can click on Shared Folders, and it will actually show you a list of all of the files and folders that are shared with the permissions. A lot of people don't realise that.
Okay,
I can't believe he's wearing a suit. That's crazy.
Well, he works for Microsoft. He's wearing a suit. What do you expect?
That's a lot of detail.
Yeah. Well, somebody thought it was important. You know, he's got a suit on. Maybe there's a different icon for a bloke that's not wearing a suit. I don't know. I mean, she just said, you know, oh, he's got this hand and he's got this, you can see his wrist and he's wearing a suit. I think she even told me what colour the sleeve was, but I can't remember. It's not really important, but there you go.
Okay, also at this stage, you can set up, so for example, you as an administrator, you're not going to want to have everybody on the network having access to all the files and folders. So this is where you'd set up your permissions for who on the network has got access to what directories or files and folders that you want them to share. Okay. You can also, another way that you could share a folder on your network is to create a drive on your server. And then the clients of the server are able to map to the network drive, and that provides access to the drive on the server, and they can then save or backup their files at that stage as well. And that's a fairly advanced way of accomplishing that type of task. Typically in that type of arrangement, your drive will be shared and you would then need a password to set on that drive to access the drive. Okay, you also may wish to, at this stage, create groups and add more users. So Windows 2000 will allow you to create groups of a whole range of different types, and you can one such type is your local groups. Where you've got a local group, you've got only it's existing on a single computer, and you've got comprised of various users of the computer. You can get more sort of like network orientated though, and what Kerry briefly talked about, global groups and domain local groups. You can also have universal groups. So the different groups vary in the way they actually function, and you as the administrator are going to be able to manage the number of users on your network. So so this is the stage when you'll be setting up all your groups. And with Windows 2000, it creates default local groups, and those groups comprise of like your administrators and your user groups. What that means is that each of the groups have a different levels of control over their local system. You can also create new local groups, and you do that through the computer management tool. You get to that by the start menu, programs, and then administrative tools. And then you can expand the directory tree, and that will reveal your local users and your groups tool. And you'll also be able to see there all of the groups that you've currently got on your system. There's a right click there that you can get the new group menu. Then you would sort of, if you wanted to, you'd give that group a name. Also give it a description, and that might sort of incorporate who are the members of that group and who is allowed what access permissions. Okay, we talked a bit about passwords and permissions, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that now. Security is really important. As an administrator, if you haven't got a secure network, then you're going to be in huge strife. So you want to be able to set all your permissions so that people can't change settings, they can't access files, and that you've got top security on your network. So it's important to have really good passwords, and the password rules we're going to go into a little bit more, but a good password should be at least 5 characters in length. It generally will contain alphanumeric numbers. In other words, you're going to have a combination of letters, numbers, and you might even add in a couple of special characters. They don't need to be unique among the users, but you should have them kept secret. And I would suggest that unique passwords with lots of different characters, uppercase, lowercase, are the way to go. You must make sure as the administrator that your users are aware that they do not share their passwords. Now, we talked a little bit about permissions, and what they are is restrictions that are created by you as the administrator and that are going to allow the enabling and disabling of actions that users can perform on the network. Just for example, you may wish to give full permission, which is what I gave to Peter earlier. So he had no restrictions and had full access to all the network. Kerry only had access to a very limited area, but we can set those permissions and we can actually change them as well. So you can actually have a number of sort of further permissions that you might wish to set up. You can say allow Grace to only be able to read files, and so she could read the contents of a file or a directory. Kieran might be able to have write permissions, so he could change or modify files and edit and save changes. And you could have Kerry here having execute permissions, and that would allow him to run files or to enter a directory. And as I said, you can change them, you can assign them so that there's one only, or you can have all of them in combination. So they also are security network important thing to have. Okay, let's do a little test here. Not sure how many we've got on just at the moment, but if our local students and Kerry could join in here too, we're going to talk about some examples of good and bad passwords. Alright, so I want you to tell me whether it's good or bad. Okay, password is capital F, lowercase sh. Is that a good or a bad password? Okay, anyone tell me why it might be bad?
Too short.
That's it. As I mentioned earlier, 5 characters is the recommended minimum. All right, the word, all lowercase, phishing. Yeah, it's bad as well. Why?
Dictionary attack. It's an English
word. Yeah, that's correct. Also, I would suggest that you should have a numeric number or another character in it. All right, what about this one? Capital F, exclamation mark, SHNGCO94. Good or bad?
Yeah, that's good.
It's Wait, actually
that, have
good.
An invalid character?
No, you can put a bang in a password. Passwords and aren't as restrictive as usernames. You can put all sorts of things in them. You can put dots, exclamation marks, question marks, and exclamation marks. I wouldn't put exclamation marks in passwords because it's a pain to put your thumb on the shift and reach for the one. I'd be going for more of the punctuation, like the commas and the slashes and stuff that are easier to get to, but that's personal preference.
Yes, so it's good because it's longer than five characters. It's got a special character, like the exclamation mark, and it's got it's got numeric numbers as well. So it's not going to be, so it's not an English word, and it's not easy to guess it. I mean, if people are going to guess passwords, they'll probably guess them eventually, but you try to make it as hard as you possibly can. I think that's very important.
And there are a lot of tools such as Crack, the password cracker, which will do the Unix ones, and John the Ripper, which is another password cracking tool, that actually have a lot of the dictionary rules in to say, try uppercase, try lowercase, try mixed case, try tacking numbers on the end. So you've got to be a bit smarter than the password crackers if somebody's going to brute force your passwords.
Okay, HTTP. Anyone tell me what that stands for?
Hypertext Transfer Protocol.
Well, good girl. Well done. So, when you're working in XP or in Windows, if we're talking about configuration of Hypertext Transfer Protocol services on Windows XP, it's basically the same as configuring HTTP services on Windows 2000. If you enable, say for example, your HTTPP on your network operating system, your computer then becomes a web server. So what I mean by that is the computer or the server is capable of sending out information on the web. In the prior versions of the Windows network operating system, you had separate programs that you had to have to allow your system to handle such operations.
Is this the point at which I point out that if you're running Windows IIS on a server that is older than Windows 2003, that you really need to go and take a few security courses? So don't deploy Windows 2000 with IIS on anything you care about. However, you will have to do it for this course.
Yes. Okay, so with Windows 2000 you had internet services built into the software. So as we talked about before, they activated and configured through the use of the Internet Information Services, or IIS tool. And that is found in 2000 under your Start, Programs, and then Administrative Tools menu. So what happens then is that displays the current computer, and the list of available internet services. You'll find the HTTP web service is found there under the default website, and by selecting the icon or clicking the plus sign, which is next to it, it expands into a navigation tree, and then there's a number of default directories and files that will show up, and that also includes the IIS service. If you were then to right-click on the default website icon, it would display a menu that enables you to start, pause or stop that service, and it also allows the configuration of the services. Okay, so once you've got your web server started, you can then view the system default web page, and you do that by... Now, this gets interesting, so I'll be talking more about this as we go along. It is in your test. you would submit the address of HTTP http, I think I put too many T's in there, :\127.0.0.1. Now, that IP address is referred to as the loopback address. That is the loopback address. What was that address, Kerry?
That address was the loopback address, the address used for local network testing, and when you wish to access the default web page of your local IIS server. That's your local IIS server running on the same machine that you are.
Yes, and that was 127.0.0.1? What was that, Kerry?
127.0.0.1. So you're logging on to http://127.0.0.1. Okay, that's in your test?
It's in your test. In case you hadn't noticed, that's in your test. Okay, and that's the networking standard address that always points to the local computer. That is, in of course, if unless a domain name system entry exists for the IP address on the network operating system. And then either this loopback address or the IP address of the system would be needed to access the pages via the World Wide Web.
Just a point here, just a very brief point. If you are setting up personal web server on Windows XP or other operating systems that are newer than Windows 2000, please ensure that you have configured your firewall software to allow connections on port 80, or you will not see your local website.
That's true. By default, your Windows 2000 will display the file name, and that's localstart.asp, and it'll do that when receiving an incoming request from your web browser. If you had the HTTP service enabled, which you would hopefully do, for the purpose of web page hosting, you would then likely update the majority of those files and settings then. Now, we briefly touched on FTP. Anyone tell me what FTP stands for?
File Transfer Protocol.
Thank you, Grace. with the release of... That's it, thank you, yes. Of Windows 2000 network operating systems, that FTP was included as a standard feature. Before that, it wasn't. So before you actually initiated the FTP service, you'd need to make sure you've loaded all the appropriate tools, and that would be specifically the IIS tools. Because they are actually necessary to run both the FTP and the HTTP services for Windows 2000 computers. And if you wanted to see if you had your IIS services running or installed, you would select the Start Settings Control Panel, Add Remove Programs, then you'd click that Add Remove Programs. There is another selection that comes up, which is Add Remove Windows Components, and then you just make sure that the IIS service was checked. If it wasn't checked, you'd actually have to check it then. Once you've got your IIS component added, the FTP service is then ready to be configured. Now, you would launch the IIS information services by going through your Start Programs Administrative Tools Internet Services Manager, and then you'd click the plus sign, which is next to the computer name, and that will show up the internet related services that you've got, and also, as I mentioned, the FTP services. There is, by right clicking on the menu there, you would have a default FTP site icon, and you can start or stop that service and pause the service in addition to configuring all the services. Once you've got that FTP service started, all of those you've authorized to be able to do so can actually connect remotely, and we'll talk about remote connection in a minute, and you will be doing a lot of that from now on in your labs. What that does is a really groovy thing, is it allows you to access files and transfer files, provided you've got all of the permissions available. Now, a number of tools that we use to do that and connect remotely, and one of them is Telnet. Now, before you can actually get a Telnet connection with a remote 2000 Windows 2000 computer even, you need to be able to configure the server to accept incoming Telnet sessions. And you do that through the, obviously again, the Start Programs Administrative Tools, then you'll get Telnet Server Administration. And you can start or stop the services there. Again, it'll be a matter of clicking on that or right-clicking on that icon and enabling or disabling that service. Obviously, you need to have administrative permissions to be able to do that. Be able to authorize to do so. Once you've got your Telnet server activated, the access then is controlled using the local user accounts that are created on that particular machine. So for example, a user to Telnet to a Windows 2000 server, the user would log on to their machine locally, and by default, the Windows 2000 Telnet server is configured to use Windows NT Local Area Network Manager, or NTLM, for the user authentication. And what that means is that the users aren't actually prompted to manually enter their username and password, but are instead verified through the logon information that's been previously submitted. With NTLM, the logon process takes place automatically, and your authorized users then will receive given a command prompt. And you can actually turn that function on or off through the server Telnet server administration tool. If you as the administrator want to, you can restrict the Telnet access to your specific local users, and I would suggest that most administrators would be doing quite a bit of that. What happens then is you can have members or users assigned to a local Telnet client group, and you can create that client group as well. Once your user finally gets logged on, they can be granted file and directory permissions, and you can do that through the command interpreter, which is actually based on the NTFS file system security. Windows also provides you with a services management control screen, and what that does is it lists all of the services that are available on the operating system. You'd also find all of your services that are currently running, services that are currently enabled or disabled. And if you wanted to look into that, you can go into the Start menu, where you would click on the Programs, then the Administrative Tools and Services. And there is a section that comes up then where you can actually right-click on the My Computer icon, and then it'll come up with a Manage or a Management screen. And you can actually select the services and applications that you want to activate or deactivate then.
Now, if at this point you're asking yourself, how will I remember all these different and bizarre and wonderful new things? May I re-emphasize the importance of actually sitting down and doing the labs, because they will reinforce the knowledge that you're getting in your notes.
You will never remember it without the labs. Just, it'll become a big blur. The labs, as we mentioned earlier, make sense of what you do in the modules. I can't stress that enough, and I know Kerry agrees with me. You must do the labs as you go along, because otherwise this is just a whole lot of waffle. Would you not agree, Kerry?
I do agree.
Yeah. So, you know, really, can't stress it enough, you need to be doing the labs to reinforce what you're doing in the modules. Otherwise, it's just really, really a whole lot of information that's going to go into the mindless areas that you might recall one day in about 50 years. You'll think, why did I think of that? Okay. Oftentimes, or typically, in a network environment, I would say all the time, you're going to have an email server. With regard to Microsoft, they use Exchange as the email server. So the client side of the email service can be a number of Office Suite products or other products even. But there's a whole lot of range, but in the Microsoft, we'd be looking at client email service like Novell GripWise, which can be accessed through Outlook, Microsoft Outlook. What your email server does is it controls all of the email that is sent and also all the email that you actually have received. So for example, when you've got me sending Kerry an email, it's first sent to the server and then it's placed in Kerry's email box, so the recipient's email box. And once he knows that he's got email there, he's got the option of reading that mail or deleting it even. And so it's like the postal system. You can decide to open your mail or you can decide, oh, I'm not interested. It's got little windows in it and I think that's going to be a bill. I'll leave that for another day. So yeah, it's like a post office. You have email working as a store and forward application. So you have the mail messages, they have identifying information that includes your sender, the receiver, and also a timestamp. And they get stored at the post office or the email server until the end recipient retrieves their mail. Current email systems also allow you to attach larger files. And that can be a document, a picture, or whatever, to the mail. Please beware, this is not covered in the notes, but many viruses get sent as attachments. So beware of, wary of opening attachments from people you may not know.
Even be aware of the ones from people you do know if they don't look like there's something they should be sending you, because sometimes one of your friends may have got hit by something and their email program has emailed out about 6 or 7 attachments before they've realised. So one of the things I tell people, and I say this at infinitum, turn off the preview pane. Do not be a slacker and read your email in the preview pane because you think it's going to be faster and you can just wind down with that scroll wheel. By the time you have realized that it's a virus, the preview pane has already opened the message and hosed your computer. Switch it off. You should be making the decision as to which emails you will open and which emails you will not. It may take you a couple of extra keystrokes to open a message, but the trade-off is well worth it, rather than having all of the data that you forgot to back up trashed by the latest virus that's bouncing around the place.
Also, not covered in the notes here is having very good antivirus programs that will stop or block any infected emails. Okay.
I was just going to say, one of the things that does sort of annoy me about these antivirus programs that do scan your email, and luckily I think you can turn it off on a lot of them, it really annoys the hell out of me that they put this little thing at the bottom of your message saying protected by insert virus name, database version, blah. I think that's probably a bit too much information that shouldn't really be bouncing around out there. If people know which antivirus software you're running, they'll know how to target it, which is just an interesting point.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Okay, instant messaging is another thing that's become very popular today, and they allow us to chat a little more readily, and people either love or hate it.
I hate it.
I like it, but I don't use it a lot. Yeah. Okay, we've talked about all the setup, we've talked about all of the things you need to configure, but we haven't discussed, when we've talked about sharing, but we haven't talked about something that is vital in a business environment, and that is sharing your printer. Okay, so in addition to all those other things we can share, setting permissions, all that type of thing, we can also set up printer services. And that's really important for businesses, because they generally buy one huge big whiz-bang printer, and they, all of the users on the network are able to use that one computer, and that is able to handle multiple jobs, multiple print services, and it allows them to sort of not have to buy a printer for each desk, and the client computers are just accessing the one computer, so it cuts down on costs.
It also cuts down on the grief, because what you'll often find is that maintaining 30 bubble jet printers with 30 different ink tanks, especially if there's 30 by 4 different ink tanks for 30 different printers, becomes an absolute management nightmare and an incredible drain on the budget at $30 an ink tank for 4 ink tanks for each of the 30 printers.
Mm. So you can actually configure a server as print server. And what that is it's a computer that's actually a dedicated computer to handling your client print requests. And it allows for multiple print requests. And I would suggest that you would need a server that has a good processor, because it's got to have, or a very powerful one, manage all the print information. So it needs to be fast so that it can handle all the incoming requests. Also, it's going to need adequate memory and also adequate disk space. So its role is to give all of your clients access to all the print resources and give them feedback on what's happening. Your printer, your print job has gone to the computer, and then if there's a problem, it'll also tell them if there's a problem. Okay? So it acts like an interpreter between your client and your printer. Okay, now often it has to put print jobs in a print queue. So it queues up all the jobs, and it will tell you if there's a delay in the queue or there's a problem in the queue. Otherwise, they go through in order that they're received. It'll also tell you if the printer's got a problem as well. You know, it might run out of ink, or it's, you know, it all gets informed along the way. If you wanted to share a printer that's attached to your local computer, you would go to the printers folder, and that's through the control panel, and then there's the printer name, and all you do then is select sharing. Okay. You can also add printers, and that's very easy to do. It always comes up with a wizard, and it allows you to double click on the add printer icon in the printers folder, then you follow the bouncy ball of the wizard. Once the wizard's finished, that printer that you've added will appear in your printers folder, and then you can your users can print it to their applications, and it works just like it's a local printer. The printer's jobs then get spooled, or what I mean by that is stored in the memory or on the hard disk, and they wait in a line to be printed. We can just see all these little jobs sitting there with a little paper saying, I'm next, sorry.
And then some administrator comes into the print administrator and drags one of the little jobs up to the top, and then all the other ones sulk because they got that job jumped the queue.
As I mentioned too, the list of pending print jobs is referred to as the print stool, a spool even. And you can use the net space use command to capture a printer port, and that can be used to capture and redirect the print jobs from your local port or LPT1 to your network printer. And the syntax for that command is entered at the command prompt, and as I mentioned, it is net space use space LPT1 colon space, then you get 2 backslash, then you put in the computer name, backslash space, then the printer name. The print server computer name is the server that's the printing device or printer name is physically attached to. Now, in Windows 2000, you can also accommodate a number of scripting languages which are used in its built-in Windows Script Host, or WSH. With Windows 2000 and XP, it allows you to create scripts using either VBS script or JavaScript language. And The Windows script host then recognizes, also I should say, recognizes another of under other types of scripting languages. So when you've got a text file created, you can name the file with the appropriate file extension, and then you may wish to indicate its scripting language in the Windows script host. What I mean there, for example, is say, for example, you've got BVS script file, it would have a .vbs file extension. If it was JavaScript, you'd have a .js script extension. I'm just scrolling down there a little bit. Okay, there does go in, and I'll just quickly go into a Windows 2000 script. If you wanted to go in your labs, you would go in to see how these scripts function. You would go into Windows 2000 or XP, for example, and you would get, for example, a simple, say you want to do a Hello World script. You can open Notepad or Text Editor and start your programs, Accessories Notepad, and you can edit this and other scripts. So what you do, for example, in Notepad, is you'd follow the line of code. You would go to the message box, MSG box, then put two quotes, Hello World, and then you would save that file to a .vbs extension. So you'd end up with Hello World VBS. And that would indicate that you had a VBS script file. By double-clicking that file, you would execute that script, and you'd get a message appear with the previously coded message. Just an interesting thing to play around with. So today we've sort of gone through the whole of the Windows install. I would suggest to you that you go and have a read through your notes if you haven't already done so. And if you haven't got all of your labs done up to this point, please try and do them up to this point, because things start to get a little bit more complex from now on, because next week we are talking about installations of Linux. So it's good to get the Windows side of things in your brain, so that when you get to the Linux stuff, as it's all new for many people, you are able to understand a little bit more of installations. Okay, any questions up to that point? If not, I've just got a quick quiz on Module 8 for you.
I don't have any.
No. Oh, good. No? Okay. All right, I got some for you guys. All right, I'm only going to do a few of these questions because there's not many of us on, so. If you wanted to configure the FTP services for Windows 2000, would you A, use the IIS component? Does that need to be loaded? B, the user must connect to the server using FTP. C, the network operating system must be reinstalled to include FTP. Or D, the FTP clients group must be created. Yeah, somebody smart. The IIS component must be loaded. Good, someone was listening. When installing Windows 2000, the setup wizard will ask you for a computer name. What is the maximum number of characters allowed for the computer name? Is it A, 8, B, 15, C, 36, D, 127, or E, 255? And you are correct, yes, 15. Or B, yes. Which of the following file systems would be most appropriate for a Windows 2000 disk partition? Is it A, FAT16, B, FAT32, C, NTFS, D, EXT2, or E, EXT3? No, that's all right. Yes, C was correct, NTFS. Okay, which scripting language is widely used in Windows 2000? Is it A, VBScript, B, ShellScript, C, Rex, or D, PerlScript? And the correct answer is A, VBScript. Okay, what level of control does the system administrator have over the network operating system? Is it A, user account, B, system backup, C, network security, or D, complete? That's correct. Complete. That's all the questions I'm going to ask you today because there's only a few of us on. Okay. As I mentioned, next week we're going to be talking about Linux installations. We are well over the halfway mark. We're having 14 modules in IT2. And the next six modules will be basically all about Linux. So, yeah, it gets very interesting. Please get up to date with your labs. I know I've said that a few times today, but please do, because you will get left behind on the Linux stuff then, otherwise it'll all get too much. So, okay, everybody, if no one has any further questions, we might all go and have morning tea. We will be available on Skype, so please feel free to contact us. And have a great weekend. Bye for now.
And goodbye from me.